Hello, folks. How are you doing? It's Danny Tisdale, and we are on the Harlem World Magazine podcast. Thank you for being with us. We took a little break to come back with full speed forward. And on today's show, as you know, we love to do, we love speaking to our leaders, legends, and trailblazers, helping our readers live their best life and style. Before we get started, don't forget to get more Harlem content and tips by following us on Apple, iHeart, Alexa, and all the other platforms where you can check out our great content and sign up for our Harlem World Magazine Insider newsletter. You also know that you can leave a review, and don't forget to share us and link to us. Today, we have a great guest to kick off this new show. And let me add that this is our 20th, believe it or not, anniversary of the magazine. Yes, started in 2003, 20 years. But anyway, more importantly, we have a great guest today, Harlem's Kim Taylor Thompson, who grew up in the famous Riverton houses in Central Harlem. Her father was a world-renowned jazz musician and ambassador to Harlem, as we like to say, Dr. Billy Taylor. She is an educator teaching criminal law and community and criminal defense with a focus on the impact of race and gender on public policy, particularly criminal and juvenile justice policy. She's won numerous awards. She is a consultant for a number of Fortune 500 companies and government organizations. Ms. Taylor Thompson received her degrees from Yale Law School and a BA from Brown University. We are very pleased to have on the show Kim Taylor Thompson with us today. How are you doing, Ms. Taylor Thompson?
I'm doing great. Please call me Kim, Danny, and it's so nice to be here. Congratulations on the 20th anniversary. That's really amazing.
Thank you very much, and we're very proud to celebrate our 20 years. We've had a fantastic team, Kim, that got us here. So I really give all props to them. You're doing good today?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Thanks.
Fantastic. You know, Kim, I don't want to say rushing a little bit, but I'm moving fast because I really, these 30 minutes always fly by and there's tons of questions that I have for you. And I just want to get right into it. Your father was Dr. Billy Taylor, a legend in Harlem. What do you remember most about him?
Well, I've got to pick a couple of things, I guess. But I guess what I remember most was his passion for jazz, justice, and family. He coined the phrase that jazz is America's classical music, really to push back on the notion that only European classical music was worthy of study and respect. Mm. Jazz was made in this country by Black folks, and it's an expression of our struggle, our history, our hope. And he wanted everybody to take pride in that. But I particularly remember the way that he envisioned and embodied jazz as a way of being. He once described jazz as the equivalent of a head held high, shoulders erect, and a clenched, pulsing fist. For him, jazz was our drumbeat. It's our heartbeat. And it was there for us as we make our mark in the world. So he was somebody who was active in work for racial equity. He's probably best known for his piece, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, which he wrote in Harlem, in the Riverton houses. Mm. And it was an anthem of the civil rights era. Yeah. It was made perhaps most famous by Nina Simone when she sang it. But it was something that was a part of him, pushing for equity, pushing for social justice. And he did it through his music and he did it through everything that he did. He taught me the importance of remembering who you are, where you're from, and giving back.
Well, Kim, he did a fantastic job because you symbolize all those things. And as we, guess you could say, fast forward, we have some other history makers, I guess you could say, in Harlem. And I'm really looking forward to this part of the conversation also. We have Yousef Salam, one of the exonerated five who was elected as a new city council member in Harlem, and also a veteran. We have new and we have old, with Keith Wright as new elected official. And you're working in criminal law, criminal justice, criminal defense. You know, it's a tricky question, but I wanted to ask you, is there a sea change? It feels like one. Well, is there a sea change?
You know, I hope so. I think that we have to hold on to this belief that we actually can continue to move forward, even in the face of all of these unbelievably conservative, racist headwinds. But I couldn't have been happier to see Yousef Salam win the primary, and I expect him to be an amazing city council person. You know, and he brings something that is sorely missing in our national conversation and our local conversation. He knows firsthand the trauma that is experienced all too often by young Black men in this country. You know, at the age of 14, he was vilified for something he never did. He was depicted as an animal, as a predator. They made up words about these five young men. They coined the term wilding, which isn't even a word, to suggest that they were wild animals. He was underestimated because others refused to see that he was valuable. They preferred to see him as expendable. And, you know, that racism caused him to experience something that was profound and traumatic and life-changing, life-altering. And he paid a heavy price for something he never did when he was wrongfully convicted of rape and imprisoned for 7 years. But he managed to overcome that, defy the odds, survive that. And even before this election, he was finding ways to call out injustice and to make a point to speak to young Black men and women and to help them have hope in the face of the bias they encounter day in and day out, and to help remind them that they don't have to be defined or derailed by the racism that they experience. I had the chance about 5 years ago to actually moderate a panel where Yousef was one of the participants. And it was for the New York Legal Aid Society. Yeah, it was wonderful. It was Yousef along with another young, an older man now, David McCallum, who also was wrongfully convicted. And we were discussing the heightened risk of false confessions by adolescents. You probably know some of these statistics, but children and adolescents are 2 to 3 times more likely than adults to confess falsely. And why this happens is that police can exploit a young person's emotions, their youthfulness, their susceptibility to pressure. You know, by saying something like, "You'll get out if you just say you did this," works with kids. You know, adults would go, "Oh, please." But a kid believes that the authority figure saying that, and they'll make up stuff just because they think that they'll get out. And right. So what Yousef was doing in this panel discussion was using his experience as a teaching moment to help public defenders better understand the injustices that are rampant in the criminal legal system. So I look forward to what he's going to be able to do in this new role. I know that he's going to turn this forum into a place for him to bring his lived experience to play, to help people find their voices, to help amplify the voices of people who've been silenced too long. So I think it's fabulous. And I do hope it's a sea change. And I think it's fitting that Keith Wright, who I've known since I was, you know, like knee-high to a duck. You know, yeah, I've known him all my life. Grew up with him in the Riverton houses. Right. That Keith was instrumental in sort of helping Yousef navigate New York politics and power. He's part of a powerful legacy of activism and hard-fought battles to amplify the voice of Black and brown folks in Harlem. And I loved, and I'm not at all surprised, that he was instrumental in preparing Yousef to be kind of a part of this next generation, right? Of home-forged leaders to make his mark. So I'm looking forward to see what they do.
Certainly so. And your comments are right on point, Kim. You know, the other thing that comes to mind, the other question really, quite frankly, that comes to mind is leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. dare I go there and say national leadership. Yes, believe it or not, I'm old enough to remember King and Malcolm. Both.
As am I.
Yes, yes. Great leaders, but on opposite spectrums. Malcolm, maybe some could say on the violent side, some might say King on the nonviolent side. Where do you think we're headed in 2023 as we look for our next steps as Black folks living in this great country?
Well, I think that one of the things that those of us who are old enough to have experienced Dr. King and Malcolm X's leadership, we keep looking for someone to sort of step up and take on that role. And we forget how young they were. We forget that they came up from, you know, marginalized communities, you know, Malcolm out of Harlem, Dr. King out of Birmingham. And they weren't, you know, on a national stage to start. They started in their communities and working with folks and understanding the experience of everyday folks and the experience of races. And they just started fighting it on a local level and ultimately rose to the top. There are countless people across the country now who are doing the same thing. And we just don't know their names, but they're working in their communities. They're getting out there and saying this needs to stop. They're working to counter violence in their communities, not by saying we need to use the same old strategies by locking people up, but they're finding ways to invest in people, give them opportunities, give them options, give them safe havens so they don't have to feel like they need to resort to violence. This is something that's coming up from the ground. Our best leaders are those homegrown community forged leaders, and they're out there right now. So, you know, we talk about, you ask the question, you know, is it going to be kind of a nonviolent approach, or is it going to be something that is not a nonviolent approach? And I guess I don't see Dr. King and Malcolm X as being juxtaposed in that way. I think Malcolm talked about violence only in reaction to the violence that was being perpetrated against the community. And that he talked about really the need to do things by any means necessary through policy, through you know, the legal system, through activism. He just found ways to really put into words what people were feeling. And Dr. King had more.
So he wasn't saying by any means necessary that's you use violence.
He was not ruling it out, but he wasn't saying that this is all about violence. He was saying, you know, when somebody comes and shoots at my community, I'm not sure I'm going to turn the cheek. I'm not sure that's a strategy that works. And, you know, we have turned our cheeks for a long time. And when we get out in the street and we say we're not going to take any more of this, that's when things start to happen. So I think what we find today is that there is an evolution of both of those threads. Those historical threads are coming together. People are saying we are not going to stand still or turn a cheek. We're going to actually get up and make our voices heard. And we're going to make you listen, because this is something that has to stop now.
Oh, yeah. I love the conversation. And I think you are so on point, Kim. And, you know, I just want our listeners to know they're listening to the Harlem World Magazine show. I'm your host, Danny Tisdale. Don't forget to subscribe to our insider newsletter and find out the best things to do in the greatest city in the world, Harlem. And also, don't forget to check us out at Harlem Week right around the corner in August. And of course, I'm speaking to Kim Taylor Thompson, and we are going to talk a little bit about her book, Progressive Prosecution, Race and Reform in Criminal Justice, that she wrote with her husband, Anthony Thompson. Kim, can you tell us a little bit about your book that they can find on Amazon and any place else?
Thank you for that plug. I appreciate it. My husband and I have long fought battles for justice reform. We were both public defenders. He was a defender in California. I was one in D.C. We taught law students at NYU to help them prepare for careers as public defenders. Fantastic. And we've written about race and equity in the justice system. But, you know, right after George Floyd's murder, we watched as people finally started to see what we have seen all along, the raw injustices in the criminal legal system. And we witnessed something, you know, the whole world witnessed something that communities of color certainly have known and experienced for generations, that it takes less than 10 minutes to turn someone who looks like you or me into a statistic, or less than 10 minutes to turn us into a trending hashtag. Right. You know, that vulgar event prompted so many to get out, even during a pandemic, to take to the streets and demand more than justice as usual. And Tony and I knew that that moment of clarity wouldn't last, right? We are a nation with a painfully short attention span. And we recognized that we needed to seize that moment to build on that outrage so that we might be able to begin to push people to abandon the racist practices of the past and to be open to more progressive approaches that might put justice back into the criminal legal system. Mm. So we decided to focus on the most important, actually the most powerful player in the criminal justice system, and that's the prosecutor. They have so much power. They decide who gets charged, whether someone gets charged, with what do they get charged. They have a lot of power. And what we wanted to do was to actually help prosecutors understand how race misshapes and distorts the experience of justice in this country, and to have them actively take steps to undo it. They were instrumental in building up this huge carceral system, and it's our view that they have a significant role in dismantling it. So we included chapters that were written by current prosecutors, by academics, by policymakers, and they were all working to give the average reader a sense of how this legal system, criminal legal system, is steeped in racism, leading to all sorts of unjust outcomes. And we wanted to give prosecutors, our other audience, a sense of the steps that they absolutely have to take to really change that system. So that's why we decided to write the book. And I focused, my chapter focused on kids in the justice system.
That's fantastic. And as you know, which is the reason that the both of you wrote the book, that that information is more than needed. Having access to it. And we'll add a link to the book when we post the interview. Of course, we're going to do that, Kim. Come on. You know, I also wanted to ask you, because we have quite a few, 35% of our readers are moms and dads. And there may be I know there's a young Kim Taylor Thompson out there listening who wants to follow in your pumps. What advice do you have for him or her?
So what do I want to tell the person who wants to follow in my pumps? I want to tell them to take off the pumps and put on some comfortable shoes, because this race is a long race and you don't want to get slowed down too much. But I would urge, you know, the young people who are coming up behind me and you to remember that despite all of the things that are in their way, the barriers, the false narratives about their lack of worth, the racism that they encounter on a day-to-day basis, that despite all of that, they are amazing. They are remarkable. They are our hope. We need young people to actually pick up this baton that we've been carrying for a while and to take us to places that you and I have never imagined. They're going to be fighting battles that are similar to the ones that we've experienced, but different in lots of ways. But the common denominator is that we're all fighting for individuals whose voices are too easily silenced, for our children whom the society devalues and refuses to see as children, and for our communities that are continue to be ravaged by systemic racism.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that helps me keep going, because, you know, there's this metronome of progress and backlash, And you just, you know, wonder if history is just going to keep repeating itself. And Maya Angelou reminds us that history, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, need not be faced again. And I think those are important words to remember, because this fight that our young people are in, and that this legacy, this history of activism, means that they have to really understand that in order to keep going, in order to keep facing these things with courage, they need to be grounded in the love of family, the love of community, the pride in our history. And that's what's going to allow them to have the strength and the resilience to keep fighting in the face of this metronome of progress followed by backlash. I think that's what will enable them to rest, rise, slay, and repeat. So that's what I would tell.
That is so good and so on point. And even though we joked and snickered in the beginning, you know, you're right on point. You know, it's going to be a long journey, and you do need to be comfortable.
Yeah, you got to pace.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, you've got to pace yourself. There's just so much going on.
Pace yourself.
And barriers. And, you know, the people who want to keep Black and brown folks, you know, pushed to the margins win when we allow ourselves to get so tired that we can't fight anymore. So you have to find ways to refill your soul and, you know, refill your spirit, and to actually go back out there and hit the streets again and continue to fight.
So on point, and my football coach used to always say before each game is to get your mind right.
Yes.
So that you can be focused for the long battle ahead. Here I am talking, and I know we have 5 minutes left. I get carried away here talking to great guests like you. But, you know, and I have two more questions. Quite frankly, I have 50 more questions, but I'll bring it down to two questions. What's your favorite place in Harlem? I know it's not a fair question. I know it's not a fair question, but I love to ask it.
Well, you know, Riverton is my favorite place because it has so many memories for me. It was the place where I was raised, where I would walk down the street, and if I did something wrong, I was disciplined by every neighbor before I got home.
That's right.
And so it's a place you know, continues to be the place that I hold dearly in my heart. But I guess, you know, the other place that I would pick would be the Apollo Theater. Largely because it's been a place where we could, you know, express our culture in so many ways, where you could go up there on, you know, and try out whatever skills you thought you had and get yanked off the stage if you had none. But it's such a real and immediate feeling of love and support from a community and with all that the beauty that we bring to this planet. So the Apollo, I think, would probably be a place that I would mention.
Certainly so. And I can understand that. And I know that we're probably down to our last, they just warned me 3 minutes. I'm adding another question, but because I just wanted to know, you know, the listeners don't know that I can see your image. She looks fabulous.
Lord,
she looks great. So how do you, what's the secret? How do you unwind? You deal with race, you deal with such heavy issues.
Yeah.
How do you still kind of relax and unwind from the day? What's the quick secret?
It's a great question, and I'm not sure I have a secret, but it's about finding the things in your life that you love and pulling those around you when you start to feel like the world is a little too tough. So I have, you know, I've been married for 30 years. I'm really lucky to have as my partner, the person who is the love of my life. I have, my mom is 99.
Good job, Anthony.
My mom is 99 years old and she brings me tremendous joy too. So having family really is critical. Listening to music is something that just, again, reawakens my spirit and allows me to feel like I can keep going. I try to exercise, probably not as much as I need to, but I try to exercise just to clear my head, right? And so that you can reengage. So those are some of the
things. I hate to do this, but the clock is ticking and they're giving me the signs. It's been great speaking to you. And I know that our readers want to stay in contact with you, buy your book. How can our readers stay in contact with you? Email, Instagram, Facebook?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram and I'm now on Threads. I used to be a Twitter follower, but no more. So Threads. So just Kim Taylor Thompson, you can find me that way.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Do not be surprised, Kim,
if I call you back. I'm very curious about how the success of those 30 years of being married. What is the secret?
I think it's laughing. But yeah,
thank you
so
take
much
care. For being on this show. Really love having you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, everyone out there. We'll be in contact with you. And thank you, Ms. Kim Taylor Thompson, for being on the show. Really appreciate it. Great meeting you. Bye-bye.
Nice to meet you.